Is there anything scarier than a cold-blooded killer? How about a cold-blooded killer who's also a child? An innocence that does not exist, only a desire for death, revenge, and blood of those they deem to be unfit to walk this earth. Today on the Dark Side of Wikipedia, we examine the cases of several child killers and the aftermath of their crimes.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Ursula Eriksson and Sabrina Eriksson are Swedish twin sisters who came to national attention in the United Kingdom in May of 2008. The twins had been in Ireland before traveling to the UK and boarding a bus for London and Liverpool. Their odd behavior after exiting the bus at a service station on the M6 motorway caused a driver not to allow them back on board. The two were later seen on the central reservation of the M6 motorway. When Highways England traffic officers arrived to assist the woman, they ran across a busy motorway, as captured by a small television crew. Ursula managed to dodge traffic, but Sabrina was knocked over. Shortly after police arrived, the woman again dashed onto the motorway and was struck by oncoming vehicles. Ursula suffered serious injuries. When Sabrina regained consciousness, she refused medical aid and attacked a police officer, at which point she was arrested and sedated. Appearing calm, though, behaving unusually, Sabrina was processed by police in Stoke-on-Trent and was later released from custody. Shortly afterwards, she was seen and taken by Glenn Hollingstead of Fenton, Staffordshire, whom she suddenly stabbed to death the next day. Sabrina was then pursued, running from the scene and arrested in hospital after jumping from a bridge onto a busy trunk road. Despite these incidents, there was no evidence that drugs or alcohol were involved in the incidents on the M6 or the killing of Hollingstead. Sabrina later pled guilty to manslaughter with diminished responsibility after an apparent episode of a show called Shared Psychosis, a rare psychiatric disorder in which delusional beliefs are transmitted from one individual to another. Ursula was released from the hospital after recovering, but Sabina was sentenced to 5 years imprisonment and released on parole in 2011 before returning to Sweden. So that's where we start today on the Dark Side of Wikipedia. These are first case. We have several of them to go through of just really utterly bizarre cases of children killing, which is out of character to, I would say, begin with. But why? How did they get there? That's what we're going to try and get to the bottom of. But it's a scary concept. Tony and Sean joining you on today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're downloading the podcast. I can honestly say I don't have a whole lot of memory about Sabina here and Ursula.
You know, you would not be the only person that has no recollection. When we're talking about child killers, what is very interesting to me, is there any correlation of being a child movie star or child TV star to child killers?
I don't know. Has there been any? I mean, there's a lot of issues, obviously, with child celebrity and then addiction and, you know, domestic abuse and such. But I don't know how much.
But does it lead to ultimately taking another life? Because so much from the psychological standpoint, when you're 7, 8, 9 years old, even younger,
yeah,
where you're forced to become an adult, you're forced to have. And obviously, as kids growing up, there's a learning curve already, mm-hmm, of how to, you know, how to ride your bike,
yeah,
how to brush your teeth, how to tie your shoes. But then to be thrown into so much, we see so much where then once they have that fame relinquished, they then kind of need to find something to match that invigorating feeling. And I'm not, I can't think of any child stars that then went on to actually take another one's life. There's a few I remember that took their own,
yeah.
But this is very interesting, the brain at such an early age to be in such a dark place where you want to murder.
It almost sounds like with this one, like it could be the direct to DVD Frozen 3, Ursula and Sabina, the cousins of, what's the names of the girls on Frozen? Elsa and Anna. Yeah, Elsa and Anna's the dark cousins, Ursula and Sabina.
Ursula and Sabina come visit for the weekend. Olaf's not going to be the only one surprised.
New from Disney DVD. Yeah.
It coming would. Up on TBS4. Yeah. Sadly, we try to make humor in death, but I honestly, to your initial question, as far as remembering this, no recollection, but yeah. There's so many stories and things where we may remember when it's going on, but literally 2 weeks or a month later, out of sight, out of mind, and then 20, 30, 40 years down the road, we come back to it, don't originally remember, but then as we learn more and we listen more, oh yeah, that's right, back in so-and-so, and I was here in life.
Yeah. I mean, this one happened over in the UK, too. So, I mean, I maybe it didn't get a lot of coverage. It was 04. So we were in the midst, I think, of still a war at the time. So maybe we just didn't have the attention span to hear the Ursula and Sabrina killing spree story. But it gets darker. So let's continue into the story of Ursula and Sabrina, Anna and Elsa's very dark cousins. Sabrina Eriksson and her identical twin sister Ursula Eriksson were born in Sweden on the 3rd of November 1967 and grew up in Soon, Värmland, with an older sister named Mona and an older brother named Bjorn. In their youth, there was no apparent history of mental health issues or criminal convictions, and by 2000, Ursula was living in the United States while Sabrina was living in Mallow, County Cork, Ireland, with her partner and two children. Ursula visited Sabina on Friday the 16th, May 2008, but for reasons that were unclear, the sisters secretly departed Sabina's home for Liverpool, England. Probably traveling by ferry, they arrived in Liverpool at 8:30 a.m. on Saturday and went to St. Anne Street Police Station, apparently in order to report concerns over the safety of Sabina's children. Liverpool police contacted Dublin to follow up on the request, learning that Sabina had a fight with her partner the previous night. At around 11:30 a.m. that morning, the pair then boarded the National Express coach to London. A police report stated that the twins suddenly disembarked from the bus at Keel Services, a motorway service station, as they were not feeling well. The driver of the bus, however, said he left them at Keel Services, even though it was not a scheduled rest stop. At around 1 p.m., after becoming suspicious of their erratic behavior, he noticed the twins clinging to their bags tightly and did not let them reboard because they refused to let him search their bags for illegal items. The manager of the service station was informed, and also feeling suspicious of the pair's demeanor, movements, and fixation on their bags, she called the police. Officers arrived to talk to them but left after saying that the women seemed harmless. As seen on closed-circuit television cameras, the pair departed the services on foot and began to walk down the central reservation of the M6 before attempting to cross it, causing chaos to the traffic and picking up minor injuries in the attempt. Sabina having been struck by a seat Leon, their elder brother claimed in a Swedish newspaper that his sisters were fleeing from maniacs who were chasing them. Highway agency officers responded to the incident, and police from the Central Motorway Police Group were called to assist. The police were accompanied by a small television crew who happened to be filming motorway cops with the officers. Standing on the north direction, hard shoulder of the motorway, the police were being appraised of the situation when, without warning, Ursula broke free, ran into the side of an oncoming Mercedes-Benz, articulated lorry traveling at around 56 miles an hour. Sabrina then quickly followed her into the road and was hit head-on by a Volkswagen Polo traveling at high speed. Both survived. Ursula was embolized as the lorry had crushed her legs, and Sabrina spent 15 minutes unconscious. The pair were treated by paramedics, however, Ursula resisted medical aid by spitting, scratching, and screaming. Ursula told the policeman restraining her, "I recognize you. I know you're not real." And Sabina, now conscious, shouted, "They're going to steal your organs." To the surprise of the police, Sabina got to her feet. Despite attempts to persuade her to stay on the ground, Sabina started screaming for help and calling for the police, even though they were present, then hit an officer in the face before running into traffic on the other side of the motorway. Emergency workers and several members of the public caught up with her, restrained her, carried her to a waiting ambulance, at which point she was handcuffed and sedated. Given the similarities in their behaviors, a suicide pact or drug use was quickly suspected. Ursula was taken to the hospital by air ambulance. Sabina was taken to the hospital where, despite her ordeal and an apparent lack of concern over her sister's injuries, she soon became calmer and controlled and was released 5 hours later. In police custody, she remained relaxed and, while being processed, she told an officer, "We say in Sweden that an accident rarely comes alone. Usually at least one more follows, maybe two." On the 19th of May 2008, Sabina was released from court without a full psychiatric evaluation, having pleaded guilty to the charges of trespassing on a motorway and hitting a police officer. The court sentenced her to one day in custody, which she had been deemed to have served, having spent a full night in police custody. Leaving court, Sabina began to wander the streets of Stoke-on-Trent, trying to locate her sister in hospital and carrying her possessions in a clear plastic bag given to her by police. She was also wearing her sister's green top. At 7 p.m., two local men spotted Sabina while walking a dog on Christchurch Street, Fenton. One of the men was 54-year-old Glenn Hollinstead, a self-employed welder, qualified paramedic, and former RAF airman. And the other was his friend Peter Malloy. Sabina appeared friendly and stroked the dog as the three struck up conversation. Although friendly, Sabina appeared to be behaving nervously, which worried Malloy. Sabina asked the two men for their directions to a nearby bed and breakfast or hotels. Hollinstead took pity upon her and instead offered to take her back to his house at nearby Duke Street. Sabina accepted and relaxed as she began to relate how she was trying to locate her hospitalized sister. Back at the house over drinks, her odd behavior continued as she constantly got up and looked out the window, leaving Malloy to assume that she had run away from an abusive partner. She appeared paranoid, too, offering the men cigarettes, only to quickly snatch them out of their mouths, claiming that they may be poisoned. Shortly before midnight, Malloy left and Sabina stayed the night. The next day, around midday, Hollinstead called his brother regarding local hospitals in order to locate Sabina's sister, Ursula. At 7:40 p.m., while a meal was being prepared, Hollinstead left the house to ask a neighbor for tea bags and then went inside. 1 minute later, he staggered back outside, now bleeding, and told him, "She stabbed me," before collapsing to the ground and quickly dying from his injuries. As a neighbor dialed the police, Sabina fled the premises and was caught on the run by nearby CCTV. She ran out of the house with a hammer, periodically hitting herself over the head with it. A passing motorist saw this and decided to tackle her and attempt to take control of the hammer. While wrestling with him, Sabina screamed and took a roof tile out of her pocket and struck him in the back of the head with it, stunning him temporarily. But this time, paramedics had found her and gave chase. The pursuit ended at Heron Cross when Sabina jumped from a 12-meter high bridge onto the A50, breaking both her ankles and fracturing her skull in the fall. She was taken to a hospital. On the 6th of June 2008, she was arrested while recovering at University Hospital of Northern Staffordshire and was discharged in a wheelchair on September 11th, 2008, at which point she was taken into custody and charged with murder the same day. Ursula was also released from hospital in September and relocated eventually back to Sweden and then the U.S. The trial was scheduled for February of 2009, but was adjourned after the court encountered difficulties in obtaining her medical records from Sweden. The trial was then scheduled to start on the 1st of September 2009. Sabina pled guilty to manslaughter with diminished responsibility on the 2nd of September 2009, having stabbed her victim 5 times with a kitchen knife. At no point during her interrogation or during the trial did she explain her actions, only replying "no comment" to extensive police questioning. Similarly, at no time was the video from the M6 used in evidence in court. Both the prosecution and defense claimed that Sabina was insane at the time of the killing, Although she'd become sane again by the time of her trial. The defense counsel in the trial claimed that Erickson was a secondary sufferer of the folie de deux, influenced by a perceived presence of her twin sister, the primary sufferer. The court also heard that she had suffered from a rare psychiatric disorder, which made her hear voices but could not interpret what they said, as well as an alternative theory that she had suffered from acute polymorphic delusional disorder. Her plea was accepted by the prosecution at Nottingham Crown Court on the 2nd of September 2010. Justice Saunders concluded that Sabina had a low level of culpability for her actions. I understand that the sentence will seem entirely inadequate to the relatives of the deceased. However, I have sentenced on the basis that the reason for the killing was a mental illness, and therefore the culpability of the defendant is low, and therefore the sentence I have passed is designed to protect the public. It is not designed to reflect the grief the relatives have suffered or to measure the value of Mr. Hollenstedt's life. No sentence that I could pass could do that. It's a sentence which I hope fairly measures a truly tragic event. Sabina was suffering from delusions, which she believed to be true, and they dictated her behavior. This is not one of those cases where the defendant could have done something to avoid the onset. Sabina was sentenced to 5 years in prison and sent to Bronzefield Women's Prison, where she turned to Christianity. Having already spent 439 days in custody before sentencing, this left her first eligible for release in 2011. Many questions were left unanswered. Some called for an investigation into the way the criminal justice system handled the matter, including Peter Malloy, an MP for Stoke South Rob Fellow, and Glenn Hollenstedt's brother, Gary, was critical of the justice system, which he viewed as enabling the murder, stating, "We don't hold her responsible the same as we would blame a rabid dog for biting someone. She is ill and to a large degree not responsible for her actions, but her mental disorder should have been recognized much earlier. I do question the criminal justice system for allowing somebody like this to be let out when she's capable of committing such a crime. Her mental condition should have been properly assessed after what she did on the motorway and the experiences the police had. Her mental disorder should have been picked up prior to her being let out into the community." Glenn saw Erickson in distress and was just trying to help. He wasn't slow in coming forward to help somebody in distress. It was in his nature. He was trying to help. He would help anybody. If he saw a fight in the street and a guy losing, he would help. So, in the case of a murder, literally a murder, and I understand there's mental illness going on here, but 5 years and you're out? That just doesn't quite seem right. I would think like life in a mental health facility might be a little more appropriate for something like this.
All right, so here's the deal. Welcome to the Young Murderers Club Incorporated, how to murder and be out in 5 years. Here's the thing. All these other people, they've murdered people, right? They've been sane. They even put a plan together in court. They seem very cool, calm, and collective. Now, here's what you got to do. Offer people cigarettes when they're about to light them. Take them away. Say there is poison. After you commit the murder, run down the block, hitting yourself in the head with a hammer. And just like that, you'll be out in 5 years.
That's all there is to it.
To my knowledge, this is the only thing different of a stone cold serial killer who is competent and someone with a lot going on. I mean, are there not other people who have killed people and they are not necessarily psychologically sane and they're still incarcerated? They don't just get out scot free because they're mentally incompetent, do they?
No, I mean, we're talking a different justice system than ours, but still, I'd say a somewhat fairly similar one. Just to give 5 years, I mean, and I don't understand the argument of this is for, the safety of the general public. Like, this is for the good. That's not for the greater good if she's out in 5 years. If she was capable of doing it then, she's certainly capable of doing it again if there's no treatment involved. And I'm sorry, turning to Christianity isn't a treatment for mental illness. And I'm not knocking religion, but it's not a fucking treatment for mental illness. So if that's all they're like, oh, she found God, now she won't go and murder more people. No, she can snap just as easily as she did before. I mean, something like this, I'm sorry, you're going to be locked away. Maybe you shouldn't be in a situation where you're in a prison type setting. That may not be the best for you, but certainly a mental health care facility where you can get treatment. You can maybe find something productive to do with your life within the confines of that area to be humane to the individual. But at the end of the day, she did this crime. She's very sick. And I'm sorry, there's just not 5 years and then you're back out is not adequate. There certainly needs to be a hell of a lot more evaluation going on here before even considering letting her get right back out to the streets, you know?
Well, what's interesting, we as Americans, and we think we're the best and we pound our chest and we're the best in the world, and then come to find out when you travel internationally or find out what things are happening across the pond, America, not as great as we once thought. But this is interesting.
Yeah.
I think if this is prosecuted in the United States of America, this is not 5 years and we're free. This is life in prison. So the Nottingham Crown Courts, you need to learn how to prosecute, because 5 years, regardless of the reasoning, is not enough for the crime committed.
Not going to, not going to cut it there. Dark one. And we move on to our next one, the story of Mary Bell. Mary Bell Flora is an English woman who in 1968, aged 10 to 11, strangled two young boys to death in Scotswood, a district in the west end of Newcastle upon Tyne. She was convicted in December of 1968 of the manslaughter of Martin Brown and Brian Howe. Since her release from prison in 1980, she has lived under a series of pseudonyms. Her identity has been protected by a court order, which has also been extended to protect her identity of her daughter. In 1998, Bell collaborated with Gitta Senri on the account of her life, with which she details the abuse she suffered as a child at the hands of her prostitute mother and her clients. Bell's mother, Betty, was a sex worker who was often absent from the family home, traveling to Glasgow to work. Mary, nicknamed May, was her first child, born when Betty was 17 years old. It's not known who Mary's biological father was. For most of her life, she believed it was Billy Bell, a habitual criminal who was later arrested for armed robbery. But she was already a baby when Bill married her mother. Independent accounts from family members strongly suggest that Betty had more than one time attempted to kill Mary and make her death look accidental during her first few years of life. Her family was suspicious when Mary fell from a window and when she accidentally consumed sleeping pills. On one such occasion, an independent witness saw Betty giving the pills to her daughters as sweets. Mary herself says she was subjected to repeated sexual abuse, her mother forcing her from the age of four to engage in sexual acts with men. After the fall Mary experienced, it was reported that she had suffered brain damage as a result, but now this damage is attributed to childhood abuse from her own mother. Mary had damaged to her prefrontal cortex, an area associated with voluntary movements and decision-making. On the 25th of May, 1968, the day before her 11th birthday, Mary Bell strangled a four-year-old, Martin Brown, in a derelict house. She was believed to have committed this crime alone. Between then and a second killing, she and friend Norma Joyce Bell, age 13, broke into and vandalized a nursery in Scotswood, leaving notes that claimed responsibility for the killing. The police dismissed this incident as a prank. On July 31st, 1968, the two girls took part in the strangulation death of three-year-old Brian Howe on a wasteland in the same Scotswood area. Police reports concluded that Mary Bell later returned to his body to carve an M into the body, abdomen, and use scissors to cut off some of his hair, scratch his legs, and mutilate his genitals. On September 17, 1968, at Newcastle Assize, Norma Bell was acquitted, but Mary Bell was convicted of manslaughter on the grounds of diminished responsibility. The jury took their lead from her diagnosis by court-appointed psychiatrists who described her as displaying classic symptoms of I can never say this word correctly. Can you say this word correctly?
Psychopathy? Psychopathy?
I can say to my head, I think you just said it. Psychopathy. Yeah, there we go.
Psychopathy.
Psychopathy. The judge, Justice Cusack, described her as dangerous and said she posed a very grave risk to the other children. She was sentenced to be detained at Her Majesty's pleasure, effectively an indefinite sentence of imprisonment. She was initially sent to Red Blank Secure Unit in Newton Le Willows, Lanarkshire, the same facility that would house John Venables, one of the James Bulger killers, 25 years later. After her conviction, Bell was the focus of a great deal of attention from the British press and also from the German magazine Stern. Her mother reportedly sold stories about her to the press and often gave reporters writings she claimed to be by her daughter. Bell herself made headlines in September of 1977 when she briefly escaped from Moore Court Open Prison, where she had been held since her transfer from a young offenders institution to an adult prison a year earlier. Her penalty for this was a loss of prison privileges for 28 days. For a time, Bell also lived in a girls' remand home at Cumberlow Lodge in South Norwood in a house built by Victorian investor William Stanley. In 1980, 23-year-old Bell was released from Axiom Grange Open Prison after serving 12 years and was granted anonymity, including a new name, allowing her to start a new life. Bell allegedly came back to Tinsdale on several occasions and had lived there for some time after her release. 4 years after finishing her sentence, she had a daughter on the 25th of May, 1984. The girl knew nothing of her mother's past until reporters discovered Bell's location in 1998, and the pair had to leave their home with bedsheets over their heads. Bell's daughter's anonymity was originally protected only until she reached the age of 18. However, on the 21st of May, 2003, Bell won a high court battle to have her own anonymity and that of her daughter extended for life. Consequently, any court order permanently protecting the identity for the convict in Britain is sometimes known as Mary Bell Order. The order was later updated to include Bell's granddaughter, who was referred to as Z. Bell's current whereabouts are unknown. Bell's the subject of two books by Gitta Senry, The Case of Mary Bell, An Account of the Killings and Trial, and Cries on Her, The Story of Mary Bell, and an in-depth biography based on interviews with Bell and relatives, friends, and professionals who knew her daughter during and after her imprisonment. The second book was the first to detail Bell's account of sexual abuse at the hands of her mother, a prostitute who specialized as a dominatrix and her mother's clients. The publication of Cries Unheard was controversial because Bell received payment for her participation. The payment was criticized by the tabloid press, and Tony Blair's government attempted to find a legal means to prevent its publication on the grounds that a criminal should not profit from his or her crimes, but the attempt was unsuccessful. Bell is one of 13 children killers reported on the Book of Children Who Kill, Profiles of Preteen and Teenage Killers by author Carol Ann Davis, published in 2004. So, obviously, an absolutely horrible crime of killing 3- and 4-year-old children and strangling them to death. But in this case, you have to look at, okay, the person that did this was certainly not all there in any way, shape, or form and was a child and suffered a tremendous amount of abuse. And, you know, the neural pathways to say this is right, this is wrong, clearly not open for business.
Yeah, it's not even that it went out of business. It never was in business. Yeah. This individual was dealt. She was born into a situation that was essentially a no-win. To have a mom who, her mom was what she was. Her her profession, if you want to call it that. She could still have been a good mom. Kind of hard to be a good mom and a prostitute, but hey, some strong, independent women, go get it. But to feed your children medication as sweets, sleeping pills,
yeah,
to abuse, to try to kill her daughter, like, my goodness, the hell. It's called just go to the hospital, drop your kids off, go away, no questions asked, and allow them to have a life worth living.
Yeah. I mean, we did the story yesterday, me and Carol did, did you see the story from Springfield, Missouri from a couple years back of Gypsy Rose and her mother, Dee Dee, the one who faked all these illnesses to get like media attention and get free housing and get all sorts of things, literally had her daughter be the subject for surgeries that she didn't need. It was just insane. I mean, it was like bordering on like Nazi concentration camp experimental things. And eventually the mother gets murdered by Gypsy's boyfriend, who also suffered from a lot of disabilities and didn't have a great mental capacity, but he was trying to essentially save Gypsy from more abuse. When you are brought up in that ecosystem, you're not going to get sane people. And you're
How weird is that? Where someone will kill another person to save them from further abuse.
Yeah.
I'm going to kill you, which is kind of bad. You would think nothing could be worse mm-hmm. than me taking your life, but I'm doing this in somewhat of an act of humaneness. Similarly to you're driving down the street and you hit a deer. And then what's the first thing when local law enforcement shows up? They confirm that the animal is deceased to put it out of its misery. You don't ever think of that from a human standpoint in stories like this. My goodness.
Yeah, it's certainly something where it's rare, but at times it seems that is the only way to really to find justice and to have the rest of the living not suffer, because that person needs to be taken out of the picture. Otherwise, just more chaos will ensue and more torture will happen. It's not just, you know, someone's negative and putting someone down. It's like, this is dangerous, horrible shit. So, yeah, in that case, it's just you have some more understanding as to, you know, where it went and why someone did the things that they did at such a very young age. Horrible, absolutely horrible. And you feel horrible for the families who suffered losing their children. But I think a little bit more understanding there in terms of how and why something like that could be going on.
You can never give reasoning or validity of somebody committing such a heinous act. But when you read a little bit more and you find out kind of the foundation, the mental foundation of it's just a tragic, tragic event from all angles.
It gives it some context, and that's the most important thing. That is going to wrap up our happy-go-lucky edition of Child Killers here on the
Sunny out there today, 76 the expected high.
On the dark side of Wikipedia. If you like our show, help keep us on the air. Be sure to give us a review there on Apple Podcasts. And press subscribe wherever you download podcasts. Let your friends know we exist as well. Until next time, for Sean and all of us at the Dark Side of Wikipedia, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.